you wake in a strange room. Your clothes are foreign, and the walls are covered in objects from a different world. You don't know where or when you are, or if you're still dreaming. There are footsteps in the hall. Jumping up, you race out of the room and into the streets. You have just entered the Twilight Histories.
Today's story is by Kevin Valbonesi. You're part of a small team entering a world that has a sparse, empty feeling. Some great thing has passed that's now in ruin. And yet, there's a constant sense of danger. Kevin Valbonesi runs Baroque Media, which specializes in tailor-made audio, video, animation, and more. If you need to add some pizzazz to your marketing, check out Kevin Valbonesi at Baroque Media. I can tell you, he's very professional and reliable, and of course, as you'll hear in today's show, the quality of his work speaks for itself. And now, for today's show, The Drowned City, by Kevin Valbonesi.
Ah, here you are. Thank you for coming on such short notice. I'm Dr. Bouchard. To my right here is Corporal Laurel Peterson, and of course you already know Dr. Guerra. I am sorry to call you all here, but we have a rather sensitive situation on our hands. Roughly 12 hours ago, we lost a probe that was conducting a preliminary survey of a recently discovered world. This probe is our latest design, equipped to provide reconnaissance through a combination of stealth and several finely tuned measurement recording devices. Its loss is both an embarrassment and a concern with regards to our competitors. Now, you're probably wondering why I asked you here. Well, the world this probe was exploring most closely resembles those that you and Dr. Guerra have been exploring for us here at the Twilight Histories. While the probe was still active, we were able to receive video confirming that the human settlements present on this world are Mesopotamian in character. Given your recent return from Assur and the circumstances of your escape during that city's destruction, we feel that you are well equipped for this mission. Please proceed to the racks over there. You'll find your garments, equipment, and everything else you'll need for this mission. Please get yourself set up while I finish your orientation. Now, as I mentioned, the cities are Mesopotamian in character, more in line with the Bronze Age than any later period. What got the higher-ups interested were two rather curious characteristics of this world: the scale, and a number of electromagnetic phenomena. The cities present here dwarf even those of the 21st century. From what measurements we were able to make, one ziggurat exceeded the height of the Burj Khalifa, which was quite the marvel in its own time. It seems that everything about this civilization was massive. I use the past tense quite deliberately, and your outfits should make the nature of this world's population rather explicit. You're not going native this time, because to our knowledge, there are no natives. The world is dead. From what we observed before we lost communication with the probe, the world has been smothered by a ferocious and enduring storm, which has led to large-scale flooding and is likely the source of the electrical disturbances which may have brought the probe down. If there were any survivors, for however long, they too will have been washed away by now. We'd prefer you come back to us in one piece, so we've equipped you for the conditions of this world. Everything is waterproof, and your packs should give you everything you need to assess the situation and recover what we need from the crash site. We would like you to make the most of your time there. So you and Dr. Guerra have been authorized to conduct preliminary research while you search for the probe. As tempting as it may be, don't linger too long. Just note down what you can, record what you can, and keep going. Corporal Peterson is here to keep you safe, and he will be responsible for recovering the probe's black box if nothing else can be salvaged. Now then, let's have a look at you all. Ready as can be, I suppose. Please step onto the platform here, and we'll get you on your way. Once you locate the black box, you can activate your emergency beacon. That should allow us to pinpoint your location and get you back here in one piece. It's just a precaution in the event that these electrical disturbances affect our equipment. Nothing to worry about, surely. I'm certain we'll see each other again very soon. Good luck. How do you drown a city? How long does that take? How much water do you need? Is the act done in an instant, as with a tsunami? Or is it a gradual process, with riverbanks and seashores swelling until they smother every brick and stone? However it happens, it all ends the same way. That's what you think about as you haul the last trunk out of the pouring rain and into the relative cover of a ruined building. You set the bright orange case down with the others, bringing their number up to 6. You bend over, placing a hand on either knee to brace yourself as you suck in the humid air. Water runs down your forehead and into your eyes, and you're relieved that it's just rain and not sweat. You feel a hand on your shoulder and turn to find Dr. Guerra, Alex to you, smirking at you from under the wide hood of her form-fitting yellow raincoat. She pulls back the hood and throws her long, dark hair out and over her shoulders. She fixes a pair of thin, wire-frame glasses, pushing them up the bridge of her nose until they frame her chestnut-colored eyes. You all right, partner? Her tone is mocking, but friendly. She gives you a double pat on the back before strolling over to a small folding table. She empties the contents of a tiny orange pack on the tabletop while staring at you, still waiting for an answer. Oh, yeah. I'm good. It's just a little humid is all. I noticed. Give it another 20 minutes and I'll look like Medusa. Dr. Guerra goes over her materials, which consist of a comb, a small mirror, a tablet, a collection of glow sticks, packets of food and water, and a Radeon 223 pistol. She places a hand on the weapon, picking it up by the grip with 2 fingers, as if to examine a lab specimen. She raises an eyebrow to you, then glances over at another table where an unopened pack sits. You step over to the table and open up the pack, rifling through it until you find what you're looking for. You pull out an identical pistol to Dr. Guerra's. You pop out the clip and find it filled with 8 iridescent rounds. Plasma, if you had to hazard a guess. You look back at Dr. Guerra, shrugging your shoulders. There's movement outside. Corporal Peterson steps in, carrying a rifle of the same make as yours. Radeon. The fellow pulls back his hood, revealing his taut, dark skin and closely cropped hair. You hadn't really noticed before, but he's a young fellow. Maybe younger than you and Dr. Guerra. Not that you're getting too up there in years yourselves. Seeing the guns you and Dr. Guerra are holding so nonchalantly in your hands, Peterson stops, instinctively putting a hand on his rifle.
Careful with those, all right? The safety better be on.
His voice is deep and firm. If he is your junior, he doesn't carry himself like it. You chalk his manner up to some sort of military chauvinism, but you don't see a point in disobeying what he says, so you place your pistol down and check that the safety is in fact on.
Thank you.
Satisfied, Peterson walks over to the case you just dragged in and enters a code into the pin pad. The unit pops open, revealing several carefully wrapped and sealed packages, mostly food and water, like the ones in your pack. Colonel Peterson? Peterson raises a finger at Dr. Guerra, wiggling it as if speaking to a child.
Corporal. It's Corporal.
Again, he's firm, and the way he raises an eyebrow makes you think that this sort of thing annoys Army guys the most. Not that a civilian like you could be expected to make heads or tails of all the different ranks and insignia. Corporal Peterson, could you please explain why my colleague and I are packing heat? I thought this world was dead. Abandoned. Dr. Guerra taps two fingers on the barrel of the pistol, waiting for what you're both sure will be a dodgy and misleading answer.
And we're pretty sure it is. But I'm not taking my chances if it ain't. Besides, natives are no. I'm more worried about our competitors dropping in and dropping us in the water. You feel me?
Peterson grasps his rifle firmly as he delivers that last line. Dr. Guerra throws her hands up in surrender, bringing an awkward end to the conversation, or at least that topic of discussion. As Peterson unlocks and opens the other crates, inspecting their contents and removing items as needed, he starts laying out your general itinerary.
All right. Our best guess is that we've arrived at 0600 hours. Conditions here are going to make a prolonged stay ill-advised, and since Dr. Bouchard there seemed pretty anxious, we're going to keep this expedition to 24 hours. Our priority is to recover the black box, so you're going to have to restrict any research to what you can do on the go, or what you can accomplish in the handful of breaks we're going to take. If we recover the black box early on, then maybe you two can get a little more done. But as it is, that's the plan. Any questions?
Dr. Guerra's hand shoots up right away. Archaeology isn't something you can just do on the go. It's a serious science, and it requires thorough examination.
I understand, Dr. Guerra, but my orders are clear, and so are yours. To be honest, you're here more to help me understand the general layout of the city, rather than to gather material for your next paper or whatever. I didn't want any civilians on this mission, to be honest, but Dr. Bouchard insisted.
Well, why don't you go ahead then? We've got a nice little camp here. My partner and I can stay close and conduct our research while you look for the black box.
No can do. It's not safe. We stick together. You can take photos on the raft. End of discussion.
And with that, Peterson breaks off the conversation, closing the crates and punching in their security codes. He then shoves a few items on another table into a considerably larger pack. Finally, he pulls his hood back over his head and steps outside into the rain. Dr. Guerra presses her palms against her table and hangs her head low, letting out an audible sigh. You give her a pat on the back.
You all right, partner?
Your quip nearly gets your head taken off as Dr. Guerra swings at you. You duck and grab your pack, shooting her a friendly smirk which instantly dissolves her frustration. She puts her hands up again, as if to say, whatever. Then the two of you finish packing up. Stepping out from under the shaky cover of the ruined building, you are immediately bombarded by a million little drops of water. This isn't a sprinkling or a splash. It's practically a torrent. The drops are thick and smash into you as if with malevolent intent. You pull on the strings built into your raincoat, closing the hood a little more, leaving just enough space to still see everything around you. The city is something to behold. There's almost no intact structure remaining, at least in the immediate area. Everything is made of stone, rather than the baked mud brick you would expect from a city raised in the spirit of Akkad or Uruk. You can't quite recognize what kind of stone makes up the bricks of these buildings. Something in its general hue and texture seems off, perhaps because of a peculiarity of erosion. And you also notice that the buildings all generally follow the same plan, with a central atrium breaking off into several smaller rooms. You also note the remains of staircases, which stick out from the rubble, some descending down into the water. You wonder just how deep the water is. Most of the homes you and Dr. Guerra have encountered in other versions of the antique Middle East were two floors at most, with only the royal residences and military fortifications having three or more levels. Looking down, the water is so deep and dark, and the surface is so disturbed by the rain, that making out the bottom is an impossible task. The ledge you're standing on now must have either been part of a balcony back in its time, or perhaps the residents constructed makeshift walkways, fixing them to the sides of their buildings as the waters rose. They would have had to add these walkways continuously over the years if the latter was the case, as even the one you're standing on now leaves you ankle deep in the water. Looking in either direction down the street, you can only see more ruined residences, with the rubble generally curving out and then upward, as if some titanic boulder had rolled through. This general scheme continues onward, until the rain and the haze of great distance make silhouettes and then phantoms of the buildings. Peterson rolls out an inflatable raft and hits a switch on it. The thing gasps for air, drawing it in until it is tripled in size. Peterson secures the raft with a line of thick cord, and then drops his pack onto the self-bailing floor. He gestures for you and Dr. Guerra to climb aboard. You carefully climb onto the raft, doing everything you can to steady yourself despite the mild turbulence which rocks the craft. You wonder at how deep you would sink, and whether Peterson would risk the dive to save you should you lose your footing. Luckily, you don't need to answer that question. You put your pack aside and lay down in the raft, spreading your arms and legs out to assure yourself that there is some solid mass between you and the water. Dr. Guerra joins you, hopping into the raft, causing it to bob and you to startle. She laughs and gives you a playful swat on the leg. You press a hand to your chest to steady your heart, and then to flip Dr. Guerra the bird. Peterson secures your temporary base, drawing a tarp over the entrance and fastening it down. He then takes out a small metal cylinder and places it among a pile of rubble before punching in a code on its tiny keypad. He pulls out a small tablet and checks something. Satisfied, Peterson covers the cylinder with a few more stones, then proceeds to unmoor the raft. He tosses you and Dr. Guerra some paddles, then jumps into the raft, making it sink just a little bit, and forcing your hand back onto your chest.
All right, we're good to go. That beacon will allow us to find our way back here if anything goes wrong. Now.
Peterson checks his tablet again, flipping through various applications until he finds one that resembles radar. He holds the device up, searching for a signal. There's a faint blip at the top edge of the screen.
All right. There's an energy signature to the far north of our position. We'll head that way, and hopefully the view is scenic enough for you too.
Dr. Guerra holds up one of the paddles, pointing it at Peterson. How can we document anything if we're on paddle duty?
Oh, we'll take turns. Besides, we'll have to stop every now and then to empty the raft.
Peterson settles into his spot at the head of the raft, rifle resting in his lap. He becomes still, and after almost a minute, turns back to look at you and Dr. Guerra. You take the hint and start rowing. Well, you sigh. Hopefully, this is the scenic route. Progress is slow. For the seventh time this hour, you're pulling the raft onto the roof of some ruined structure, carefully removing all your cargo, and then turning the craft over with a heave to drain all the water. Once the craft is free of its burden, Peterson squats down to flip it, but you stand up, crossing your arms. Peterson drags the raft away from the water's edge and extends both arms in a universal gesture for what now? Colonel.
Corporal.
Corporal, sorry. Can we please take a break? We've been rowing for hours.
Hey man, I'm getting tired too. But if you want to take a break, you gotta pick a better spot than this.
You cast your eyes around, taking in your surroundings. The roof you're standing on is a less than ideal place to stop. It's exposed, without so much as a brick to shield you from the wind, and it's covered by a few inches of water. You pick up your paddle, conceding the matter. In a minute or two, you're all back on the water. You groan as you and Peterson stroke, and stroke, and stroke, driving the raft forward down the seemingly endless corridor of ruined structures, almost all damaged with the same curious curve. Your effort slips, and soon the raft is pulling too far to the left. Peterson stops rowing and reaches back, snatching the paddle from you and handing it to Dr. Guerra. She takes the instrument without a word and trades places with you. You're moving again within seconds. You recline in your spot, and giving a quick glance around, you assure yourself that there's no significant structures. Just more of the same. Making the most of your time before a paddle is back in your hands, you attempt something crazy. You try to make small talk with Peterson. So, Corporal, what do you think of all this? Peterson doesn't turn back, but he answers.
Pretty tame, all things considered. Dr. Bouchard there really sold me on the mystery, you know. But it's just rocks and rain.
Well, I admit, the places Dr. Guerra and I typically visit are usually more interesting than this. You definitely would have gotten a kick out of Assyria, if state-sponsored terrorism is your thing.
Maybe. I don't know. The people upstairs don't usually send me to anywhere we're bringing tourists. I don't go anywhere without my rifle, so there's not a lot of opportunities to go native. Nah. They send me to some real far-out places to deal with some real far-out problems.
Like what? Dr. Guerra chimes in. Can you tell us, or is that classified?
Some of it, yeah. I mean, what I can tell you is still pretty crazy, at least compared to this place. I remember one time they sent me to a Mars colony. Crazy stuff, man. People shooting at each other all the time. You could never tell if someone bled out or if that patch of dirt was just moist. I think it was just something in the air, you know. They've been terraforming the planet, but they didn't quite get it right. There was some tech that the higher-ups were interested in, so I went to fetch that.
That sounds crazy, all right. Peterson looks back at you, smiles. That's all it took, listening to one quick, and probably exaggerated account of his exploits as a time-traveling mercenary extraordinaire.
You know, I did hear about this other mission they were sending some people on. Crazy, man. Something about lizard people on a planet near Earth, but like, way in the past or something. I think that'd be something. My dad used to read me all those old Conan stories. Homeboy was always fighting those lizard people. I'd kill to play Conan for a day. Skin myself a lizard, make some nice boots, you know?
Sure. I don't think there are any lizard men here, but maybe we'll find something that piques your interest. Actually, Dr. Brera leans in, almost conspiratorial, there were these artifacts recovered in the same part of the world we're in now, back in our timeline, of course. They were these little figurines that were definitely not human. Archaeologists started referring to them as the Ubaid Lizardmen.
No kidding. I wouldn't mind getting my hands on one of those. You think you can dig one up here?
Anything's possible. For the first time since you arrived. You're all smiling. Peterson nods, clearly daydreaming about getting his own little lizard man to decorate his quarters back home. You and Dr. Guerra share a smile, content that the slow ride north might be a little more bearable now. With everyone enjoying the moment, it's no surprise that everybody is shocked when the raft runs into something, jolting you all. Dr. Guerra almost loses her paddle, and Peterson nearly hurls his out of the raft too as he reaches for his rifle. Without any warning, Peterson switches off the safety and fires, hitting something just a foot away from the raft. Once he realizes that the thing in front of him is just a piece of solid stone, Peterson flips the safety back on and lowers his rifle. A small, smoldering hole occupies the center of this curiously shaped mass.
Sorry, guys. I wasn't paying attention.
Peterson reaches for his paddle, but you grab him by the arm. Hold on. What is that?
Probably just some debris.
But it's not just debris. You know it can't be. The contours of the thing are smooth, purposefully shapen. The thing is shaped like a thin egg, and it rests on a broader foundation. The word forms in your mind, but Dr. Guerra says it first. Statue! It's a statue! And she's right. Looking it over, you realize that this is indeed a statue of some humanoid figure, or at least its head and shoulders. You recognize the general outline, with a beard, flat nose, and two recessed areas with bulges in the middle. Eyes, surely. The head's proportions are long, with the top taking a curious spiral shape with two lumps on either side. It must be a statue of a god. Maybe that's a crown on top. You're thinking the same thing. But which god? That answer seems so far away because the figure is so eroded, obliterating anything that would hint at the figure's identity. The more you look at the thing, the more uncomfortable you get. The facial area is where the erosion has done its worst, leaving the figure a nightmarish blank slate. You don't say anything to Dr. Guerra, who is already holding up her tablet and snapping photos. Instead, you wait for her to finish, then grab a paddle and push the raft away from the unsettling obstruction. Hey, why'd you do that? Dr. Guerra looks at you, obviously peeved. She angles the tablet to the side, snapping a few more pictures, then turns her hardened eyes toward you again. I wasn't finished. Sorry, Alex. I thought you were. And besides, the raft's getting a little full.
Man's right. We should empty this out.
Dr. Guerra puts her tablet away. She glares at you. But her hard feelings don't last too long. Eventually, she busies herself with flipping through her newly created album, already studying the images, despite the annoyance of countless drops of rain peppering her screen. You notice that you're on a different street now, since the buildings ahead of you are not ruined at all. Glancing back at the statue, you realize that your raft had drifted into a large clearing, occupied by the stone sentinel. You communicate this to Peterson and he nods.
It's all good. Just took a wrong turn. We'll take the next left.
You row for another 10 minutes, and even though Dr. Guerra's turn comes up, you don't dare disturb her. She's already got her stylus out, and she's scribbling notes to herself, stopping only to wipe her screen when the water builds up on it too much. Finally, after stopping briefly to empty the raft, you take that left turn, and to your surprise, the path doesn't lead you down another monotonous street. Instead, you're greeted by a vast expanse of water. You and Peterson stop rowing, allowing the raft to drift forward while you take in your new surroundings. The area is vast, perhaps as large as a lake, maybe bigger. It's hard to tell because the line of buildings behind you stretches out and around in long arcs in either direction. And when they do bend and come around, you can't see far enough ahead to confirm that they do in fact come together again. The only thing you can see in the midst of the vast waters is an island, made from what you assume to be the top floors of some old tower. This solitary structure differs in its construction so drastically from everything else, with its floors spiraling upward like a corkscrew, reaching for the heavens. Vast arched windows open up onto the water, and from what you can make out, the lower ones are large enough to allow your raft to pass through. You look at Dr. Guerra, then at Peterson. It takes only a moment for you all to nod to each other. Peterson hands his paddle to Dr. Guerra, then takes up his rifle, bringing the scope to his eye. He looks about, doing his best to inspect the building, moving across each floor, then up, in slow intervals. Satisfied that the coast is clear, he signals for you to row. With slow and measured strokes, you and Dr. Guerra propel the raft forward. As you draw nearer to the structure, you realize that you underestimated its height. It seems to get taller and taller, looming over you, threatening to tip over and send you down into the deepest, darkest depths. You try to keep your eyes focused on the path ahead, and with some slick maneuvering, you manage to slip the raft through the open window and into the blackness of the mysterious tower's interior. With a twist, you activate your glow stick, casting a diffuse yellow glow out in every direction. Dr. Guerra and Peterson turn their glow sticks on as well, and with three lights now operating at maximum strength, the darkness of the interior is somewhat dispelled. The room is so vast, however, that persistent shadows still lurk in its corners. At a glance, the plan of the interior is such. A central spire rises up, casting out stone buttresses which press against the walls, keeping the entire structure in a delicate equilibrium. The masonry is the same curious stone that the other buildings are made of, but of a darker hue. You know that the materials are the same because the grain of the stone is entirely consistent with what you discovered before. In terms of ornamentation, there is none. At least at this elevation. Perhaps the lower floors held some records or artwork, but those had long been swallowed by the deep rolling waters. And you were secretly glad that you were not sent here with diving gear, for the descent might be to nightmarish depths. The only significant structure which concerns you and your party is the spiraling staircase which is built into the inner walls. The steps and railing emerge from the water and spiral up in a counterclockwise direction. You are able to make out a ceiling high above the water level. So, there is a floor up there, somewhere you can walk. You help Peterson drag the raft up onto the staircase and secure it to the stone railing with a length of cord. As you pull the knot tight, you glance over the railing, seeing the water lapping but a foot or two below you. The knowledge that where you kneel would once have been sufficient for a fatal fall manages to trigger a sensation of vertigo. Once the raft is secure, Peterson takes up his position ahead of you, rifle ready.
All right, I'm pretty sure we're still alone, but let's not get sloppy. Get your guns out.
Peterson's manner is commanding, not in a lordy way. Rather, you sense genuine concern. Trusting in this career army man with a love of lizard men, you pull your pistol out, keeping it pointed down.
You've got flashlights built into the barrel. But make sure the safety is on before you light up the torch.
You follow his instructions to the letter.
All right, I'm going in first. You do not raise your pistols until I say so, and you do not aim while I'm directly in front of you. Do you understand?
You and Dr. Guerra nod.
All right.
Peterson turns on the flashlight built into his rifle.
Let's go.
Peterson begins a slow and measured ascent up the steps, with you and Dr. Guerra following 6 feet behind him. The ascent is difficult by sheer virtue of its length. The staircase spirals around the room so many times, its vertical progress impeded by the occasional leveling out of the path to accommodate a buttress overhead. You make the entire journey in complete silence. And finally, you reach the ceiling, where a small passage gives access to the floor above. Peterson signals for you to stop, and you do. He inches up through the passage, poking his head and rifle up into the room above. He sweeps the room, eye pressed to his scope. After several minutes, he lowers his rifle and signals for you to come up.
Put the safety back on. I don't want to get shot in the ass.
You comply with a chuckle. You go to open your pack, but Peterson holds out a hand.
Hey, I didn't say put them away. We need a little extra light up here.
You grasp your pistol, and after exchanging a look with Dr. Guerra, you continue up and onto the next floor. You step up and into the massive chamber, with the stairs stopping at the level of the floor, before picking up again some 10 feet ahead. And from where you stand, the room is pitch black, with not a window in sight. Casting the beams of your flashlights across the room, you can make out the central pillar, continuing up from below, as well as a relatively lower ceiling. You notice curious metal mirrors built into the ceiling, and even in the floor. Cursory glance down shows the floor to be free of any holes, not that you'd go running around the room anytime soon.
All right, let's take it easy for a minute. You can put your packs here by the stairs. Stay near the walls and watch your step.
Peterson drops his pack and lets his rifle hang down. He stoops down and rests against the wall, closing his eyes. You let your pack slip from your shoulders, and it hits the floor with a hard thud and splash, harder than you care for. Stooping down, you open up the pack and check to ensure that everything is intact, which thankfully it all is. Your hand touches the floor, and you feel a trickle of water. You cast your light along the tiny stream, finding its source coming from the floor above, with the water cascading down the steps, along the floor, and down the stairs you just came from. You wonder if the stream continues all the way down. Perhaps you hadn't noticed. Details like that are easy to miss in so vast a place. What's harder to miss are the curious curves carved into the wall. And not a moment after Dr. Guerra sets down her pack, she covers her mouth and nearly falls over as her body light reveals the nature of the shapes. Even Peterson springs up, not startled, just vigilant. You all stare at the wall, and it takes a moment for anyone to speak up, with Dr. Guerra finally doing the honors.
Válgame Dios. Finally.
You second that sentiment. Here now, after countless hours of slipping and sliding over cold, dead stones, is something that at least resembles life. The reliefs are the nearest relative of those found in the great cities of Mesopotamia that you have so frequented across time and space. That familiar flatness of design, made elegant only by a smoothing out of the bevels, greets you. You see men with long braided hair and beards standing in profile, almond-shaped eyes without pupils, fixed on taller figures, presumably the gods of this world's pantheon.
They're like the walls of Nineveh.
Dr. Guerra runs a gloved hand over the wall, tracing the bevels, caressing the beards of the silent crowd gathered in adulation of their divine lords.
They're men. They're all dressed in the Babylonian fashion. And here, these gods, perhaps they are Marduk, Enlil, and Shamash.
Dr. Guerra raises her pistol, sending the beam from her flashlight down along the walls, catching narrow glimpses of more and more relief work. The light catches on one of the metallic mirrors set into the wall, bouncing off. Dr. Guerra approaches the mirror, tracing its edge with the light, revealing a pair of figures carved in relief, both of whom appear to be carrying the mirror, from which chiseled rays of light radiate out in every direction.
It must represent the sun.
As Dr. Guerra says this, she lays her hand on the surface for only a moment. She looks around, running her other hand over the chiseled beards of the mirror bearers. When she finally takes her hand off the mirror, she's stunned to find the surface giving off a faint light from a shape resembling her palm. Alex, be careful.
Don't touch that, Dr. Guerra. We don't know what that material is.
But she doesn't listen. She runs a finger along the surface of the metal, leaving behind a fake glimmer.
Dr. Guerra, enough.
But she's not listening. She places her palm on the mirror and pushes, which immediately generates an intense azure glow. Dr. Guerra recoils from the mirror, covering her eyes. You and Peterson raise your arms and turn your heads, shielding your eyes. The intense glow dies down and is replaced by a seemingly all-encompassing and moderate glow. You look around and see similar metallic mirrors, the ones set in the floor, ceiling, and in the wall reliefs, all growing luminous. Dr. Guerra rubs her eyes, and stepping away from the mirror, she regains her composure.
Alex, what did you do?
I don't know.
How is this possible?
The whole room lights up as if you were standing outside on a sunny day, the sickly blue hue aside. The entire circumference of the room and all its magnificent relief work are now on full display, and the sight nearly snatches your breath away. Dr. Guerra paces around, excited, slipping and sliding as she traces the entirety of the frieze, following countless men, gods, and monsters in their eternal procession around the room. You rush after Dr. Guerra, though slightly more mindful of your footing, leaving Peterson alone in stunned silence. While your eyes don't linger long enough on any particular section to give great insight, the general themes of the frieze are readily apparent. Men wielding spears, axes, and bows march about, laying low their enemies, who are curiously depicted here as serpents, dragons, and men with ill-proportioned limbs. You see scenes of the victorious men carrying back curious circular stones toward their cities. Conquest and the spoils turn to objects of worship as kings, priests, and gods alike all marvel at the stones, passing them between each other, setting them up on pedestals, and building complex geometric housings for them. You bump into Dr. Guerra, who is standing in stunned silence before one section of the wall. You check to see if she's all right, but she doesn't even turn to look at you. She simply reaches for your head and turns it to face the wall. This section of the frieze is separated from the rest by a thick border. Within the frame, a peculiar and dramatic scene plays out. A god wearing an ornate crown and flowing robes heaves one of the curious orbs high above his head, sending rays of light out in every direction. You follow the rays around until they are met by the outlines of fierce waves and stones. Your eyes return to the god, and you marvel at the determined gaze on his face, carved with precision and lifelike quality not typical of Mesopotamian art. You follow the god's gaze downward until you meet the object of his glare. A massive sea serpent is shown rising from the waves, its mouth agape, bearing long, sickle-like fangs and a tongue that undulates like a serpent itself. The beast looks ready to swallow the god, but it is perhaps only being held back by the rays emanating from that strange orb. Looking at the wall directly adjacent to this frieze, you see another image with the serpent coiling up at a distance from the armies of the great god. The beast is alone, save for the dark and brooding clouds which hover over it. Going any further along the wall brings you back to the presumed beginning of the story, with the men of this great city marching out, led by their god. Alex, it's beautiful. This must be their supreme god. It could be El, but if that sphere is giving off light, like all the others in here, then maybe this is Shamash, the sun god.
Could be. I've seen reliefs like this before, in Babylon. Do you remember? But they always showed Marduk, in that case, battling with the old goddess of the seas.
With Tiamat.
Tiamat.
Yes. You look around the room, considering everything about this curious place and the city beyond its walls. I wonder if this work is more recent than the rest. The style is so advanced. And these lights. I don't know what kind of technology this is, but it's nothing we should be seeing from a civilization like this. Maybe it's a metaphor. The sculpture, I mean. Whatever these lights are, I think the people here revered them as gifts from the gods. Maybe gifts from the sun. And Tiamat, the dragon. Maybe she represents the flood. And her monsters, too. Maybe this is a story about how the people of the city attempted to preserve it against the rising waters. You let that theory sink in. You touch your hands to the expertly carven stone and wonder at the antiquity or modernity of it all. You sit down and lay against the relief, again trying to take in the entirety of the room. Peterson approaches the main relief and looks up at it in awe. He fixes his eyes on the giant serpent goddess, Tiamat. He notices that the eye is made of the same glowing material as the mirrors, and the effect gives one the impression that the beast is looking directly at you. Peterson stares at the serpent's eye for longer than he should, before shuddering and strolling off.
Lizards, man. Snakes and lizards.
For the next hour or so, you and Dr. Guerra scour every corner of the room, making detailed notes about everything, capturing photos on your tablets, and working to collect samples of the materials. Pretty soon, your tablets are filled to the digital brim with data, and you're both back in front of the main relief, puzzling over the mystery of it all. Did you find any cuneiform? You shake your head. Dr. Guerra looks around, worrying that perhaps she's missed something. You give a quick glance around as well, but you're certain that there wasn't a single character in the entirety of the room. Entirely pictorial. You'd think that if a king, or anyone for that matter, built something like this, you'd have something to say about it. Well, maybe they preferred to show. It's not like all the walls are blank. A lot are, which is strange too, but at least there's some record. I mean, it is just one building in a pretty big city. I'm sure if we keep looking, we'll find more.
Yeah, you're probably right.
Dr. Guerra looks over at Peterson, who's working diligently to clean his rifle with all the parts spread out on a waterproof blanket.
Hey, Peterson, we've got everything we need here.
Peterson quickly puts his weapon back together and tidies up.
All right, I'm ready. Let's see what's upstairs.
Peterson hauls his pack on and waits for you and Dr. Guerra to do the same. All ready, you ascend the steps and find yourselves once more in the tired monotony of a spiraling staircase, a central pillar, and a mess of buttresses. You climb and climb and climb, casting your lights upward in search of the next proper floor. It's 20 minutes before you finally reach another chamber. This one is dark, though less so than the room you were recently exploring. And there are large windows which let in powerful and humid gales from outside. The light they let in is pitiable, either because of the intensity of the storm, or because what passes for nighttime in this sunless world is fast approaching. Dr. Guerra finds a metallic mirror set into the floor, and she stoops down to press it firmly with the palm of her hand. As before, the mirror lights up, casting an azure hue in every direction, joined shortly by all the others in the room. The glow is less vibrant here, but it's strong enough to reveal a curious set of large mirrors, four to be exact, set into and around the central spire. You and Dr. Guerra approach the devices while Peterson peers out of a window through the scope of his rifle.
I don't suppose there's a magic telescope somewhere.
Peterson quickly rejoins you, letting his rifle hang by his side.
What did you see?
Nothing. I think the storm got worse. I could barely make out the building we were hiding in earlier.
You didn't think visibility would be poor up here?
I thought it'd at least be better than down there. It's all good, man. We'll just wait for things to clear up a bit.
You bury your hands into your face and rub your temples. This place is flooded. I'm pretty sure things aren't going to clear up anytime soon. Before you can castigate Peterson again, you hear a low humming. You turn and find Dr. Guerra pressing on one of the giant mirrors with both hands, causing a noticeable glow to appear on the center of the disc. The glow becomes so intense as to almost be blinding. Then, it appears to physically come off of the surface. You pull Dr. Guerra away from the mirror, ducking down just as a powerful beam of light erupts forth, charging out through a window and into the dark, undulating clouds beyond. The other large mirrors come to life and do the same, firing powerful beams of light out into the darkness. You wait, thinking that maybe the light would dissipate, but the beams hold. Curious, you rush to one of the windows and look out over the water. With visibility vastly improved, with more and more of the expanse becoming clear as the beam of light intensifies. Peterson raises his rifle and peers through the scope.
Nah, man. I don't believe this.
Peterson pulls his tablet out, checking the radar-like application. The signal is still to the north, but much closer now. Peering back through his rifle scope, Peterson becomes excited. He reaches out and grabs a fistful of your raincoat, pulling you close. He hands you the rifle and points at the scope. You have a look, wondering what has Peterson so ecstatic. And it's not long before you see it. The thing is pyramidal in shape, rising hundreds of feet above the city's skyline, weighing upon the surface of the earth. Neither Khufu nor Nimrod, nor even the mythical Atlas, could call their monuments more than a cornerstone in comparison to this mountain of human achievement. How you couldn't have seen so massive a thing through the atmospheric haze puts the frightening truth of the city's scale on full display. You struggle to comprehend what race of men could have raised those stones, and what power the rulers of the city held to compel such labor from its citizens. Your legs give out, and you collapse onto the floor, grasping at Dr. Guerra and Peterson. They grasp your raincoat and keep your head from banging onto the cold stone floor. You begin to drift away, darkness creeping in from the edges of your vision, despite the intense beam of light mere feet from your face. Before you completely lose consciousness, you see a terrified Dr. Guerra looking down at you, tears welling up in her eyes. And then, it's blackness. You wake up with a bright azure light seeping through your eyelids, blinding you when you instinctively open them. You recoil, rubbing your eyes, and you don't stop until someone grabs you and pulls you forward.
Hey, it's me, it's Alex.
You wince and struggle to open your eyes. You see a blurry yellow mass in front of you, but in time, clarity returns, and you see that it's Dr. Guerra in her raincoat. She puts a hand to your cheek and then to your forehead. Then, she curls her hand into a fist and pops you in the shoulder.
Don't you ever scare me like that again.
What happened?
You lost your cool, man. You were out for hours. We had to drag you down the stairs.
You turn and find Peterson seated at the head of the raft, paddle in hand. Looking around, you realize that you're out on the open water,
accompanied by the bright beam of light from above. It also takes you a moment to realize that it's not raining. The sky is still dark, and the wind is still strong enough to whip up some serious waves. But that accursed rain has stopped.
Did you see it? Alex, did you see it?
Yeah, I saw it. My head almost exploded when I saw it. It's huge. I mean, just what's above the water. I can't find the words.
Yeah, huge works,
Peterson adds.
Speaking of the thing, we're not getting there unless we both row.
Dr. Guerra takes up her paddle. You try to take the paddle from her, but she holds it out of reach of your hand and shakes her head.
You can take it easy for a little longer, man. But don't worry, your turn will come up.
You recline in the raft, and finally settling, you set your gaze ahead and spot what so recently smashed your senses. Far away, but still looming like an impossibly large mountain, the ziggurat awaits. The thing has large, regular steps, with staircases rising up along the walls, crisscrossing the front, all connecting with a massive central staircase. The central flight of steps rises up from the water below, climbing up the mountain of masonry until it reaches the summit, which is crowned with a curious structure at the top. You notice a small, smoldering area of the ziggurat, where choking black fumes rise up and into the sky. You would not be able to see the curious spot were it not for the bright beam of light which illuminates the scene like the lamp of some antediluvian lighthouse. What is that?
If I had to hazard a guess, that's our crash site. The jet fluid must have caught fire on impact and has been burning ever since. If we're lucky, it didn't melt the black box.
I don't suppose we're packed for mountaineering.
Oh, come on, man. We're taking the stairs.
After what feels like an hour, with several turns taken between you and your raft mates, you finally arrive at the effective foot of the ziggurat. You pass several more eroded statue heads, which all stand like silent sentinels around the megalithic site. Despite the general facelessness of these mason-made giants, you feel as if what were the eyes are tracing your path as you cruise by them. You hop out of the raft upon reaching the main staircase and drag the raft up and onto the nearest level, finding some debris to secure it to. Peterson makes you run through a weapons check, insisting that even here, in the relative brightness, you keep your flashlights on. For if your competitors or anyone else were to surprise you, the light may blind them in a pinch. All set and armed to the teeth, you take to the central staircase once more, beginning your expedition of that man-made Everest. The presumed crash site is at a distance of some 500 feet up the structure, and it still burns, as if maintaining a signal fire. You move with some urgency under Peterson's direction, conscious of your exposed position and excited at the prospect of exploring the behemoth beneath your feet once the black box is secure. You continue to climb at such a clip despite the growing soreness in your legs. There is only higher and higher and higher. After considerable effort, and with your endurance all but spent, you finally emerge onto the level where the smoldering ruin awaits. Peterson keeps his rifle high and leads you on a thorough inspection of the crash site. And like the rest of the city, the place is abandoned. Only twisted and burning metal populates the area. You remark on how the surprisingly large remains of the probe resemble the exoskeleton of some colossal insectoid. Broken bits of the shell lay scattered here and there, with the liquid fuel spread all about the site, still burning, giving off an uncomfortable heat, even at what you first assumed was a safe distance. Peterson gestures for you to step back. He pulls a small canister from his pack, rips the cord, then tosses it into the flaming wreckage. There's a bang as the grenade explodes, sending not shrapnel, but foam out and over the searing fuel and metal. A massive plume of smoke rises as the flames are finally extinguished and the metal cooled so that it no longer glows a demonic red. After a few minutes, the foam dissolves, leaving nothing but the wreckage, and a much clearer space for investigation.
All right, we're looking for exactly what it sounds like. It's a black box with gold details like circuitry. You find it, call me over right away.
You all get to work, scouring the remains of the probe, turning scraps of metal over and tossing them off and onto the lower levels of the ziggurat. As you clear more and more of the crash site, you notice that there's hardly any damage to the stone. And these massive blocks which make up the structure are of a different material than the rest of the city. Their cast is of a deep black, with strange currents of faded green running through them. Curious, you drag a jagged scrap of metal across the surface and find that it leaves the stones unmarred. You try again, thinking that the rain must have softened the surface after countless centuries of constant bombardment, but no. The stone is firm, unfazed by your efforts. Looking up at the ziggurat, you notice that nothing about it is eroded or damaged. The structure, save for the general dampness of its surface, looks as if it were carved yesterday.
I think I found it, Dr. Guerra shouts. Here, help me with this.
You and Peterson rush over, joining Dr. Guerra as she stands up from a crouching position by a large and mangled piece of the probe. You place your hands on the side and push, rolling over the unit with considerable effort. The metal crashes aside, leaving a distinct black cube with golden circuitry exposed on the damp rock. You're also excited to have finally found the box that you don't immediately notice the huge piece of metal rolling over and over, until finally, it plummets over the edge and crashes down onto the lower level of the ziggurat with a thundering crack. The mangled unit continues to do this, tumbling down the side of the ziggurat with loud booms until it finally crashes into the water and sinks out of view.
Whoops. Hope nobody minds,
quips Peterson. Unconcerned, he turns to the black box, picking it up and giving it a once-over.
It's intact, thank God. And that means we can finally take it easy.
You all let out a sigh of relief and crouch down, laying out on the cold stone surface to finally catch your breath. Your downtime is cut short, however, as an unimaginable crashing sound booms out across the city, shaking everything. So powerful is the blast that you feel the sound waves rumbling through your flesh. Then, darkness comes. The light from the distant tower vanishes in an instant, leaving you with only the general dimness of the stormy sky to give shape to anything in front of your eyes. As you all scramble to your feet, hearts pounding in your chests, you see that the ordeal is not over. Where once the tower stood, there is now a surging wall of water rushing toward the ziggurat. You forget that you just endured a hike which would leave most sore and on their backs for days. Right now, your body's only concerned with its future condition, And so, it spurs you into action without requiring any conscious thought. You bound across the level and back onto the staircase, Dr. Guerra and Peterson on either side of you. Glancing over at the incoming tsunami, you judge that it will in fact carry you away if you're not tens of feet higher in the span of a few minutes. Rushing like the incoming surge, you and your comrades ascend the staircase, desperate to reach the relative safety of the summit. You push yourself harder and harder, sucking air into your chest and spewing CO2 out as you push your human engine to its limits. You feel the wave smash into the ziggurat below, and you nearly lose your footing. But mercifully, you stay upright and continue your desperate scramble, finally throwing yourself onto the summit. Permitting yourself a look down at whence you ran from, you see the waters cascading back down the levels of the ziggurat, maybe just 10 or 20 feet from the edge of the summit. You curse between labored breaths and vomit when your body finally remembers the strain it just put itself through. What the hell was that? What happened to the tower? Dr. Guerra responds between panting breaths. Maybe it collapsed. Oh my god. We were just in there. And surely, the tower did collapse. But if you have any inkling that it was a structural flaw, you are quickly dissuaded of that notion. From where the tower once stood, a raging vortex swirls, drawing massive blocks of masonry down into the unseen depths. But while much is pulled below the waves, something else is rising. You notice the water bulging in several places, rising several feet in the air, thrown up in a frothy surge as some colossal bulk emerges from beneath the waves. It's only when the water crashes back down and runs off the side of this monstrous form that you comprehend what you are looking at. Your mind immediately recalls the bas-reliefs in the tower and the scenes of this antediluvian race's supposed struggle against a rising sea. You think of the grotesque and undulating forms of those creatures which the long-gone people clashed with in their past, driving them back into the sea. Here now, not frozen in stone, but wriggling with all the vigor of life, is the body of some immeasurably long serpent. The coils of this aquatic dragon continue to rise and rise, wriggling about and sending small tsunamis in every direction. Finally, with a great eruption of water, the head of this primordial being of phonic terror rises up to fix its hungry gaze upon the summit of the ziggurat. You choke on your words, unable to even scream, as you look at the misshapen face of that ancient dragoness with its snub nose and crocodilian jaws. Long whiskers run down either side of its hideous face, undulating and whipping themselves about as if they possessed a sentience all their own. Two glowing azure eyes fix themselves on you and your colleagues, and in that instant, all your wonder at what cataclysm could have undone this great city is dispelled. The beast roars, and the resulting blast from its mouth is enough to send you sliding across the slippery stone until you crash against the walls of a covered altar. Thunder roars and lightning arcs across the sky. The heavens let loose the rain which they had been storing, nearly drowning you as the initial torrent crashes down.
"We're getting out of here now,"
yells Peterson. He empties out his pack and grabs a curious device shaped like a detonator, replete with a tiny screen built into the side. Peterson flips a switch, and the device comes to life, though the screen crackles with static. making it difficult for Peterson to accomplish whatever he's trying to do. The dragoness, meanwhile, dives back into the water, sending more colossal waves out in every direction. Her head breaks out from the water again as she lunges up and over in an arc before crashing down into water again, closing the distance between you and her.
What are you doing, Peterson?
It's the emergency extraction beacon. I'm trying to get home base to lock onto us, but there's too much interference.
A massive bolt of lightning arcs across the sky directly above you, the thunder booming an instant later. Electrical interference? Yeah, no kidding.
God damn it, I can't get it to work.
You flounder about, looking for any escape, turning away from the chaotic waters and the approaching Titaness. You look under the roof of the structure and find a stairwell hewn into the rock. You rush over and look down, finding it spiraling downward into impenetrable darkness.
Guys, over here!
Peterson is still trying to get the beacon to work, but to no avail. He and Dr. Guerra rush over and join you, looking down the stairwell.
If we go down there, there's no guarantee the home base can pull us out.
I don't care. You tell me. You rather deal with what's down there or what's up here.
And what's up here is frighteningly close. The beast lunges up from the water, the base of the ziggurat, slithering up the central staircase at an alarming speed. With less than a few seconds between you and the jaws of Tiamat, you take the risk. Grabbing Peterson and Dr. Guerra by the raincoats, you dive headfirst into the stairwell, avoiding the fangs of the beast and the collapsing masonry as the creature bites through the structure. Water surges up and into the stairwell, dragged there by the sheer momentum of the beast. You, Dr. Guerra, and Peterson tumble down the staircase, now swept down even faster by the rushing water. As you continue to roll and tumble down, further and further into the unknown depths of that monument of the once mighty race which ruled this city, you are accompanied by the echoing roar of the pitiless serpent who returned the world to the primordial waters of chaos from whence it came.
That was The Drowned City by Kevin Valpanese, and you can find Kevin at Baroque Media, which I'll include in the show notes. I made a members show a while back on the Sack of Baghdad, and it seems timely to bring it up now. While I'm working on the next installment of Blue Dragons, have a listen to this sample and see if it tweaks your interest. I have for several years restrained myself from mentioning the Tartar event, the remembrance of which causes me to shudder. Even now, I hesitate to recall it. So began a survivor's account of the sack of Baghdad by the Mongols. In 1 week of intensive and systematic sacking, the greatest city in the medieval world, the center of science and philosophy and art, was destroyed. Rumors spread throughout the lands that the Tigris ran black with the ink of books and red with the blood of philosophers. It was as though an asteroid had struck the heart of the world. When the Abbasid family took over from the Umayyads, they inherited a massive empire stretching from the Atlantic Ocean to the Indus River Valley. It was the largest empire the world had ever seen, larger than Alexander's empire, larger than Rome at its height. When the Abbasids took over, this vast empire was nurtured into a ripe and luxurious golden age. The Abbasids preferred wealth to austerity, science to theology, and they had an appetite for art. A new beginning needed a fresh new city, and the caliph was drawn east towards the ancient and cultured world of the Persians. Sailing up and down the Tigris, the caliph was told of a good location by a community of Christian monks. The spot was nestled within a nook of the Tigris. It was cooler in the summer than other places, and it was surrounded by good lands that could be cultivated. Perhaps symbolically, it was also not far from the fabled ruins of Babylon. The Greeks and Romans designed their cities using the Hippodamian grid system. Their walls followed the natural contours of the land. The streets were not bothered by hill or valley and produced square blocks that we recognize in our cities today. They sought order in breaking with nature, or perhaps even dominating it. The caliph was inspired by the Greeks and Romans, but did not quite build his city according to the Hippodamian grid system. He did not seek to dominate nature, but to emulate its most perfect form. For this, he was inspired by a Greek mathematician, Euclid. Baghdad was to be built in the shape of a circle, a powerful symbol of harmony. At the heart of the circle, you would have seen the caliph's Golden Gate Palace, a massive structure with a green dome that rose 127 feet above its superstructure. Next to this was the Great Mosque, an equally impressive building that showed the bond between this world and the next. Four wide roads radiated from the center of Baghdad. These roads were shaded from the intense summer sun by vaulted arcades, where you would find lively shops and bazaars, spices, colorful clothing, toys. This was not a city of black robes and veils. The main roads would lead you to a double circuit of walls. The outer walls, reaching a height of 80 feet, only made taller by the vast moats beyond. Thousands of architects and engineers, legal experts, surveyors and carpenters, blacksmiths, diggers, and ordinary laborers were recruited from across the Abbasid Empire to build these walls. One contemporary estimated that 100,000 people were involved and that it was the greatest feat of engineering in the Islamic world. From these walls rose four huge gatehouses. If you were to stand on top of one of these towers, you would see the entire breadth of the circular city behind you. To the north, east, and south was the Tigris, which wound around the city. To the west, you would see the inhabitants spilling out beyond the walls with their shops and bathhouses, mosques and bazaars. Beyond this were unending groves of lush palms and emerald fields, watered by a vast network of canals, all fed by the Tigris River, as thick as the Nile and sparkling in the sun. Baghdad was a center of knowledge in the style of a Hellenistic city. If the medieval world ever had a library that could compete with that at Alexandria, it would be called the House of Wisdom. The House of Wisdom was a library that eclipsed all others in its time. Scholars from across the empire and beyond came to this library, where they would debate and lecture. An army of scribes translated every book they could find. Unlike the Library of Alexandria, the House of Wisdom drew heavily from Persian, Indian, and even Chinese texts, in addition to those of the Greeks and Romans. Astronomy, mechanics, geometry, philosophy, mathematics. There were extensive works of Sanskrit and Urdu poetry. There were schematics by Greek inventors. There were treatises on the caliph's excavations at the pyramids. There were maps of the world made by cartographers who had an intense desire to get the distances just right using Greek geometry. You can imagine spending hours flipping through the catalogs and pulling out wheelbarrows of fascinating works that no longer exist today. This interest in knowledge led to a revolution in education. Knowledge was prized. It was a sign of status. A scholar would never go hungry at Baghdad. Wisdom was so valued that books were sometimes preferred as war booty. Ptolemy's Almagest was claimed as a condition for peace at the end of a war between the Abbasids and the Byzantine Empire. I love the idea of a war over a book, especially a book about the motion of the stars and planets. Baghdad was the city of 1001 nights, and most of these stories take place there. It conjures up images of magic carpets, genies, harems, and treasure houses full of silks and gems. It inspires images of brightly colored philosophers debating in the arcaded streets, of inventors building stunning machines, of eccentric alchemists trying to create gold, and of artists and architects building dazzling palaces. Baghdad, before it was sacked by the Mongols, was the exotic center of a civilization rich with art and fables. But that all came to an end. That was the opening of a member show called The Fall of Baghdad. If you want to hear the rest of the show, along with scores of others like it, go on over to the website at twilighthistories.com and click on the page called Members. You not only get tons more audio stories, but you also help support our growing team. When the members area grows, this podcast grows. Again, that's twilighthistories.com and click on Members. I'm Jordan Harbour. Thanks for listening to the Twilight Histories. Until next time, take care.